Our nation's unemployment rate has dropped to its lowest levels since the pandemic struck. But the Labor Department says the number of long-term unemployed, it barely budged in November, still hovering around 2.2 million people. So with that economic backdrop in mind, we're discussing a recent study from Harvard Business School that takes a really hard look at hiring practices in America. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Have you been out of work in the pandemic? What's your experience applying for jobs? Have you used online tools like a jobs platform or apps to help? 800-642-1234. Manjari Raman is director and senior researcher of the Managing the Future of Work project at Harvard Business School. She was lead author of the study called Hidden Workers, Untapped Talent. Manjari, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Good morning. Thank you for having me here.
Good morning. So let's start with those two words in the title of your study. Who are these hidden workers? Give us a profile of the people who are in this workforce category, if you will.
Absolutely. This work came pre-COVID. We began thinking about this issue of all these employers always complaining and saying we can't find the talent we need, whereas we knew that there were lots and lots of unemployed people. So we started looking at three economies, the US, the UK, and Germany, and we started looking at who's not working and why aren't they working? And what is keeping them out from work? And why is this talent hidden? And what we found is there are almost, we had about 17 categories of people. There were people who were caring for children. There were people who were caring for older folks and friends and family. There were veterans. There were refugees and asylum seekers. There were immigrants, people who were facing mental health challenges or were physically facing challenges, people with substance and alcohol abuse issues, people who were previously incarcerated. It was a long list. Mm-hmm. And we found suddenly that there were also people who might not have checked all those boxes, but just because they were long-term unemployed, they were now unemployable. So we found that there were, in the US, for example, and this was a ballpark number pre-COVID, about 27 million people.
Wow. 27 million people who are unemployed, who have really been trying to find employment. And you sent out, was it like 8,000 surveys, in the U.S. and abroad to figure out, to really dig down deep into this problem?
That's right. And, we wanted to make sure that we heard from these workers and we heard what their experience was. What kept them out of the workforce? Were they applying? Were they not applying? Because often there's a myth out there that those who are unemployed don't want to work. Well, that didn't turn out to be true at all. In fact, these workers were applying up to 22 times and getting rejected. Hmm. And, how many of us have applied to a job, felt rejected, and then never wanted to apply to something again? Nobody likes rejection. But these folks, over the last 5 years, we asked them, how many times have you applied? A majority of them had applied to more than 10 positions, for example, and barely got more than one call back for an interview. So there was clearly something going on in the way we hire that was preventing employers from really seeing these workers and, bringing them into their organizations to solve their talent problem.
So it sounds like this perception that is out there, that this stigma about laziness, that is often a complaint you hear about the long-term unemployed, that just doesn't hold true.
It's an interesting word that you use, and it brought forth a memory. If you were an economist and you were looking at the long-term unemployed, if you go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, for example, the term that is often used is, these are technical terms, by the way, that economists use, marginalized workers, discouraged workers. These are the technical terms we use when we are counting people. We accept that people are discouraged and out of the workforce. So it's not laziness. It is discouragement, because if a person says, I want to work, I can work, but they are eliminated because they were previously incarcerated, or because they don't walk or talk or look exactly like the perfect candidate that a company is looking for. People are just discouraged. They are not lazy about applying. They're not lazy about saying we want to work. But I think as employers, we have a perception of, I want the perfect candidate. And the perfect candidate need not look perfect, walk perfect, talk perfect, but actually be great at doing what your job is and, you know, doing what the employer wants them to do.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Manjari Raman, co-author of a study looking into the ways traditional hiring practices can exclude different categories of workers. And she's a senior researcher for Harvard Business School's Managing the Future of Work project. You can join in. Have you been out of work during the pandemic? What have your applications been like? What have companies told you? 800-642-1234. Manjari, there's the perception that hiring hidden workers is risky. They won't add value to my organization. They won't fit in right. They won't thrive in my company. To what extent is that true or not?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that question. When companies think like this, typically what they're doing is they're focusing on the worst case. And what they are not doing is counting the hidden cost of what their practices are really doing. So let me count the ways, Shakespeare would say, in which companies are hurting themselves. You keep a position open. And by the way, I want to be very clear about this. When we were looking at hidden workers, we weren't just looking at high-skilled hidden workers. We were looking at folks who are, you know, middle-skilled hidden workers, people who don't have a four-year college degree. You take a position which is a position that doesn't require a four-year college degree. And the number of days that job is left open, the cost associated with that, the cost of constantly rehiring, the cost of supervisors having to take on more training and bring on more people on board, and they leave again because they are not happy. The categories of people we were talking about, they want to work, they want to stay. When you start doing the math on their staying longer, less churn, the desire to be with the company, do the best for the company, actually the math works out in favor of the company. So the superficial way of thinking and saying that hidden workers are, you know, people, honestly speaking, a big category in hidden workers is older workers.
I wanted to ask you about that because Wisconsin is aging. It's a long-term demographic trend here that we don't have enough young workers coming up. We have an aging population. How is ageism in hiring? What do you see out there?
So the fallacy out there is you want to get rid of older workers so that you can bring down your costs and you can bring in younger people. That sounds great, but guess what happens when you get rid of your older workers? All the tacit knowledge, all the experience, all the management skills, everything goes out with the older worker. Older workers are a great asset. Once again, we're doing the math incorrectly when we're looking at older workers. And, you know, we saw this in COVID times that across the world, actually, not just in the United States, but Italy was one of the first countries to do this. When they needed doctors and nurses, they begged people to come out of retirement. Right? And people did. And they brought their skill set with them and they helped fill the gap. And that's how we have to think about this talent problem that we face in the United States. Instead of forcing people out of work, we have to bring them back to work.
Harvard Business School's Manjari Raman leads the Managing the Future of Work project, collaborating with Accenture on a 74-page study examining hiring processes and examining the workforce at large. Do you think Wisconsin and the nation is experiencing a worker shortage? Or do you think it's really a mismatch, as some economists have now labeled it, this labor and skills conundrum? Join in with your experiences in finding work, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Manjari Raman here on the Ideas Network. Anecdotally, of course, it seems those help wanted signs are still up all over the place. We're learning how companies can make smarter hiring decisions to uncover talented workers who are getting skipped over in the pile of job applicants. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A recent study found a so-called hidden workforce of 27 million people in our country who would gladly fill jobs. Are you in that pool? What have the rejections been like? Do you think technology plays too much of a role in standard hiring processes? 800-642-1234. Harvard Business School's Manjari Raman directs the Managing the Future of Work Project, co-authored the study, and is with us for the hour. Let's bring on a caller. Tim is joining us from Marshfield. Hi, Tim. What is your situation?
Hi. Yeah, like you guys had discussed earlier that, you know, there's a lot of talk about people believing that people unemployed right now are lazy and don't want to return to the workforce. But in my perspective, I stayed home to raise my two kids right now because it would be safer and cheaper than daycare costs. And the work provided for us right now is really not the best profession to be in if you don't have the four-year education after school or the work experience they ask for. You're kind of at the whims of your employer, and you just kind of sit around and see that you're barely making ends meet with the wages you make, and you're seeing other people that have seniority over you that are just kind of phoning it in, and you just kind of get disgruntled and kind of fed up with these jobs that are offered to you.
Tim, it's really interesting, and Manjari, I want you to weigh in here, but saying daycare costs would have been higher by Tim staying in the workforce, so staying home looked like a pretty good option right now, especially if you don't have all of the skills that your colleagues do have. What are your thoughts on what Tim's saying there?
You know, I think it breaks my heart to hear what Tim is describing, because this is the truth for so many Americans who have so much to contribute, who can be so productive and be doing so much more for themselves, for their families, and for the employers in their community. Look, when we were doing hidden workers, we didn't just look at people who were not working full time. We looked at people who were missing hours. So Tim, for example, is taking care of his children, but there's a lot he could be doing a few hours from home. There are those who are missing from work. That means that they've been long-term unemployed, but they're still seeking work. And then there are those who are completely missing from the workforce, because as Tim said, if you keep trying and you don't make progress and you are always stagnating, of course you're going to feel discouraged. That's human nature. I think a lot of this is a function of how employers think about talent. As long as employers believe that workforce development is something that happens outside their company, their job is just to go into the spot market, find who is available, fight for the most perfect candidate that they can find, and then, you know, completely ignore the hundreds of and millions of people who actually want to work in their organization, well, it's the fault of employers. You know, Tim talks about the discouragement he felt when he was at work, when nobody was paying attention to what his future should be. Surely, if you're a performer and you're a high performer and you're telling your organization, I want to grow, I want to stay here, I want to build a life and a career here, because guess what? I like coming to work here. This is convenient to my family needs. I find that I can get here. I have transportation that brings me here. Once people have those three things taken care of, people actually don't want to move. Employers are missing this point completely. Employers are putting up with high amount of churn. Employers are constantly blaming other employers and saying, I lost talent because that company across the street paid $1 more. No, you lost talent because you didn't do enough to retain your talent when that talent was in your company. And by the way, you didn't hire the right talent.
I want to look at that, what you just ended on, hiring the right talent and the impact of automation that has come into hiring practices. Can you explain to what extent that these processes in hiring, what role automation has in it?
So automation has been playing a role in shaping this sorry state of affairs for almost the last three decades. And it's been happening in two different ways. On the one hand, every job, every occupation in every industry is getting more and more automated. And technology change is resulting in employers shifting to bringing in younger people who are familiar with the technology rather than investing in training those who are older in the and know the old ways onto the new technology. The second effect that automation has had is, let's say for some reason you dropped out of the workforce. Like Tim, he dropped out for a brief period of time because he wants to take care of his family. Perfectly reasonable reason. The problem is, if Tim is out of the workforce for 2 years or 3 years and now wants to get back in the workforce, he's got a black mark against him on his resume.
There's a gap.
There's a gap. And employers are using automated systems where anybody with a gap is automatically eliminated and not even considered. So how many of us, Tim is a great example. He's a dad who stayed back to take care of a family. But in many, many cases, it's women mm-hmm. who are getting educated, who are 50% of the, people with BAs that we are churning out in our country. But when they join the workforce and they start having families and raising families, women are unable to come back into the workforce. So really the challenge we are seeing here is the filters that we're using in our automated hiring systems are very often designed with a negative bias of how can we eliminate rather than an affirmative bias on how can I widen the aperture of the lens with which I perceive people?
I want to just jump in here and reintroduce you, Manjari Raman, co-author of this study looking into the ways traditional hiring practices can exclude different categories of people, senior researcher for Harvard Business School's Managing the Future of Work project. Manjari, how aware are companies of their screening tools for their applications? I mean, from your surveys, are companies aware of their own filtering?
They are. And, just as we talked about surveying 8,000 workers, we also surveyed thousands of employers of all sizes, small, medium, large, and across industries. And we very clearly got feedback that employers are aware that their practices are not getting them the talent that they want. Employers are aware that they are not getting the people, that there are people in the local community who would be happy to do the jobs that they are offering. And the challenge is that within organizations, the manager who is missing, let's say, a supervisor. So let's say we are talking about a fast food chain and mm-hmm. it's a franchise and they're looking, the manager needs three workers for the restaurant. The hiring will be done in a central way by somebody in HR. And HR is getting inundated with 100,000 applications. So HR's instinct is, how do I cull through these 100,000 applications to get the best candidates? And HR is not doing anything unreasonable. That's actually how any one of us would react if we were doing the HR job. But the problem is when you add all these seemingly good ideas at the company level within a company, and you add them up across the economy, it just starts becoming a bad practice where we are no longer doing things like job fairs, where you could meet people one-on-one, make eye contact. I don't know, Kate, how you hire, but when I hire, a lot of my hiring is based on intuition. And what is that intuition? That intuition is actually full of bias. It's how do I hire people who look like me, who talk like me, who went to the same institutions that I went to, who, you know, enjoy the same lifestyle I enjoy.
Let's pause there. Harvard Business School's Manjari Raman looking at that tool of untapped talent and hearing your story, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update here on the Ideas Network. The trade group, the National Federation of Independent Business, reported last week in its quarterly industry trends report that small businesses in every industry are facing challenges like staffing shortages, and owners are working hard to attract the right workers to their positions. Harvard Business School concluded in a recent study that said, look, employers can do better in their hiring. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Employers, are you finding a strong pool of applicants with the skill set you need? What have you learned in the Great Resignation? Job seekers, have you been unsuccessful in landing interviews and offers? What might be going on? 800-642-1234. The study is called Hidden Workers, Untapped Talent. And Harvard Business School's lead author, Manjari Raman, stays with us for the hour. Let's bring on another caller. Ken is joining us near Hayward this morning. Hi, Ken. What is on your mind? Hi, Ken. Are you there? And I think we just lost Ken. Manjari, Ken was wondering, what about corporate profits here for shareholders instead of focusing on worker wages and ensuring that workers have the regulations and protections that they need to thrive? What do you see going on in that realm?
It's a great question. And, you know, I'm always very cynical when there is any conflict between a shareholder and a good practice. Are there shareholders out there who want profits at the cost of making workers not do well? Are there shareholders out there who don't understand that a good workforce, a well-trained, happy, motivated workforce is the secret to higher productivity and better profits, better customer experiences? I think not. I think mostly shareholders should get that and understand that shareholder wealth comes from employee productivity, and employee productivity comes from having motivated employees who want to stay and work and grow within the organization and not having employees. So take, for example, all the airlines who suddenly had to cancel flights. Because they couldn't find people to fill those positions and they couldn't man those flights. So they had to ground planes. Is the shareholder benefiting when that happens? I don't think so. So to make sales happen, to make operations happen, to deliver value in products and services to customers, you need employees. You need the right people at the right time in the right quantity. If you don't have that, you're failing the shareholder. There is no conflict between doing the right thing for employees and having a great workforce. And companies that are smart know this, understand this, and their shareholders get it.
I want to run something by you. There was a debate earlier this year in our state about why workers weren't coming back to the workforce and taking especially frontline jobs. And some lawmakers said it was because the unemployed were getting an extra $300 a week in their unemployment checks. And that federal aid was a big problem. When you looked at that aid, do you think that was having an issue on why unemployed workers weren't coming back to the workforce?
You know, to me, that sounds like, imagine a fast moving river and somebody is flowing down that river and you throw them a life jacket and then you say, oh, that person doesn't swim well because they're using a life jacket. A cause and effect is getting completely mixed up here.
Mm.
We heard from Tim just a little while ago. What did he tell us about his experience while he was working? He was ignored. Mm. His efforts didn't lead to anything good happening. He probably was working in a position that had long hours. He was working for very low wages. The wages were hardly enough to subsist. Do you really think people, sane-minded people, want to come back to positions like that? When there are a million positions available, people are making smart decisions and choosing where they want to work. What did COVID teach us? COVID taught us that the essential people for delivering goods and services to customers are actually those who don't have a four-year college degree, right? So whether you're in a grocery store and you're stocking shelves, or whether you're a transportation person and you're driving long miles, whether you're working in a warehouse, whether you are, these are the people who are keeping America moving. These are the people who are the lifeblood of what's happening in the country. They are essential. White, so-called white-collar workers and high-skilled people, what happened to them? They sheltered. They were able to stay at home.
Worked from home.
But these essential workers needed to be out there when COVID is there, deliver food and services, deliver groceries. And I just think it's highly, highly unfair to now say that these workers, because they've got some compensation for the time when they weren't, I mean, this compensation, is it enough to retire? Is it enough to send your child to college? Is it enough to pay a mortgage? Is it enough to buy a house? Of course not. These are all people who are looking for work and they want to go to jobs that are going to treat them well. And employers need to make sure that their jobs and their cultures are treating these workers well. Then they won't have problems.
We're talking with Manjari Raman, co-author of a study that looked at ways the traditional hiring practices are excluding workers. Let's bring on another caller, Dan in Madison. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hey, I'm an employer in a manufacturing business, and I applaud what's being said. I agree that as employers, it's important for us as business people and as moral citizens to pay a living wage and to be treat our employees in a reasonable way. And of course, it makes good business sense to retain employees. So I agree 100%. But I would say that part of the problem is that a lot of the middle management positions are no longer exist. The types of work that people did, say, 10 or 20 years ago, record keeping, for example, is no longer needed. So a large swath of people who have a given skill set is no longer valid. But I would also argue that in people who are seeking jobs need to take some of their own personal responsibility. We employers certainly need to do a better job, but people who are seeking jobs need to look within. And if they're applied to 20, 30, or 100 positions and are not getting a job, they need to look at themselves. What am I doing wrong? For example, if a person thinks the work is beneath them, well, certainly I don't want to hire them. If I have a job that requires X skills and X effort, but a person feels that job is beneath them, as long as I'm paying a living wage, then shame on them, because sometimes we all, even as the owner of a manufacturing business, need to do what needs to get done.
Dan, thank you. I just want to pause right there because you bring up such an interesting tension. Manjari, go ahead.
Dan, first of all, thank you for coming on and bringing the voice of business to this. And I understand what you are saying, But I do have to say that the number of people in our research that would turn down a job because it was beneath them was negligible. But the number of people who were being turned down and not recognized for the value they would bring was huge. So the problem we have here is, and to Dan's point, look, when we are talking about hidden workers, I think what is new and different about the approach we are advocating in this report and in this research is that it's not as if every business can hire everyone or even should think about doing that. All we are saying is, if a business is facing a talent shortage, can it look at its own hiring practices and find ways to improve its hiring practices so that it is bringing in more diverse talent than it was narrowly looking at earlier? Of course, Dan is right. You want to hire people who are motivated, who want to work in your company, who take pride in the work that they do, who want to be future supervisors, trainers, and teach other young or new people how to take pride in what they do. And no position is, you know, too low or too grand. 100%. You want the right motivation. You want the right values when you bring people into the organization. But the whole purpose about thinking of about this, Dan, is to think about it as strategy. So if you are thinking about manufacturing and you need certain high-skill positions, and what has happened in manufacturing over and again, we hear the story so many times that the older workers in manufacturing can no longer be used in the same organization because due to automation, you know, as Dan said, I don't need a bookkeeper anymore. Yes, but you are still keeping books, Dan, except you're now using a software. And so now you have somebody else who has a four-year college degree who is now keeping your accounts for you, or you're doing it yourself. The fact is that a lot of the tasks still remain, but they are now automated, which makes those tasks more complex. And for that, employers have to lean into training the workers they have and equip them to deal with the tasks with automation. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Instead, employers were letting workers go and assuming they'll just bring in new workers with the right talent and the right skills that they required.
Oh, almost like disposable fashion.
In a fungible fashion. And, you know, employers are not evil. And employers are not stupid either. Everything that employers are doing, they're doing rationally because they believe it's good for their company. And overall, I have great faith in employers that they're trying to do what's good for their employees. It's just that these are consequences that are not thought about. And let's also give employers a break, because what has been happening is work life has undergone massive changes, many, many forces of change. In fact, in previous research, we counted up to 24 different forces of change that are changing the way work is done. And this has all happened in the last two or three decades, all the way from outsourcing, technology coming in, globalization, demographic trends, the aging workforce, changing norms about education, even changes in how families, the rise of more single parent families, all of this is impacting who works, how they work, where they work, and what work they do.
A workforce storm, if you will.
It is a storm. Employers are caught in that storm.
I just want to jump in here. Harvard Business School researcher Manjari Raman explaining a recent report found many businesses have a filter to exclude applicants. We're looking at the wider issue on the workforce with your stories. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. People continued leaving their jobs in high numbers this fall. The Labor Department said last week 4.2 million people quit their jobs in October. Openings rose to 11 million. Notable, though, here on the home front, a new survey from a Milwaukee PR firm said half of working women in Wisconsin are thinking about quitting their jobs. Still time to talk about what you see out there on the hiring scene. 800-642-1234. Harvard Business School's director of the project called Managing the Future of Work, Manjari Raman, stays with us for about nine more minutes. Let's go to Michelle in Middleton. Hi, Michelle. What's on your mind?
Hi there. I wanted to share my own experience. Thanks for taking my call. My spouse and I went down to one income during the pandemic, and we had a baby. We took the time and, you know what, we're home, let's have the baby. Now that, you know, things are lightening up, my spouse has decided to stay home with the baby, has enrolled in a four-year degree, and has found a lot of fulfillment staying at home. And I think that we also need to keep in mind that people may have been forced down to one income, may have found the fulfillment staying at home, and also may not mentally be ready to go back. I mean, we have quite the shortage of therapists and psychologists right now, and there's a lot going on that people just may not want to go back.
Michelle, thank you for sharing your story. Manjari, what do you pick up on in what Michelle says there?
What we've been through with COVID has been life-changing for all of us, and it has made all of us think about our futures, our present, what is the meaning of life, ask some really fundamental questions. I have no doubt that there are folks like Michelle, many, many of them, who are rethinking, re-wondering. But, what Michelle's spouse is doing is saying, I want to go back to school and figure out what I want to do so that when I do get back to work, I'm doing work that I find interesting, I find, meaningful, and which allows me to raise a family, provide for them. And Michelle and her spouse are making the right choices for themselves at this point of time. Kudos to them. However, a lot of the work that we did in these hidden worker research, when we are talking about the 27 million, these are people who want to work. Hmm. They want to get back to work. And, this is what was disheartening. We asked them, how did things worsen for you, for these hidden workers? So these were people who wanted to work but couldn't find work. And we asked them, in COVID, was it harder or more difficult for you to find work? And 44% of them said it was just as hard. Hmm. Pause for a minute. That means pre-COVID, think back to your life pre-COVID. These were people who were suffering what we all suffered during COVID. Insecurity, not knowing what's going to happen, not having a job, wanting to work, being not able to work. Not being able to plan a future, not being able to plan expenses. This is their life. These are people who want to be in the workforce. And, given that we're in the last 9 minutes, I wouldn't want to leave this section without one very, very key important thing that needs to be done for this to be fixed. One of the things we're saying in this research is, look, we're not saying to employers, you can hire everyone, but you've got to have a business strategy that makes you look at the hidden worker type that is good and great for your company and will create the talent pipeline you need. And let me give you a very simple takeaway on one thing every employer can do. It's when you're putting out a job posting, just please take a look at it and edit it. This is not rocket science. But one of the worst practices that we have is we put out job postings. If someone says, let's refresh it, refresh stands for let's add more things to it. No, go in the opposite direction. make your job postings very concise and only focused on what you must have. So I was looking at a state of Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development projection. So they were looking at between 2018 and 2028, which are the industry sectors that are going to grow. And the biggest sector over the next decade is going to be education and health services. And under health services, as you can imagine, all the caregivers, we had Tim on the call, who's a caregiver, Michelle's spouse, who's a caregiver. Do you think these people would be great to have in the workforce when they're ready and want a job in the workforce for health services? Of course.
Absolutely.
They have real practical caregiving experience. But any caregiver, are you allowed to put that on your resume? Is that recognized? There are now mom resumes that actually list their caregiving capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the same, you know, Wisconsin Workforce Development report projected what are the 15 top skills that are going to be required. Let me read those out. Some of them. Critical thinking, active listening, speaking, reading comprehension, social perceptiveness, judgment and decision making, time management. Does any of this sound like rocket science? Does any of this sound as if an older worker, someone who was previously incarcerated, someone who is a veteran, that these are beyond the capabilities of those people? No.
And Manjari, we only have a minute left, but do you think employers will take this to heart? What are you watching for as the future of work unfolds?
They have no choice. It's in their business interest. If they want to serve their shareholders, if they want to, you know, if you're the CEO of a company and you're facing a talent shortage, you're basically wasting time and not selling your goods and services. So it's in your best interest to figure this out and stop waiting for the perfect candidate and start hiring the perfectly capable candidate.
Because certainly, as you found, they are out there in droves.
That they are. And it's only up to us as an employer to open our eyes, to make sure that we make them feel welcome. Most hidden workers, 88% said the very initial application process is intimidating.
Hmm.
For many of these workers, just the way our job descriptions are written, you know, research shows that women will not apply for a job unless they check 100% of everything that's asked for. So that's 50% of the workforce who could be working in your company. And if you have too many things you're asking for in your job description, well, women are not going to apply.
Manjari, thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Kate. I really enjoyed this.
Manjari Raman, co-author of a study looking into the ways traditional hiring practices can exclude different categories of people. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.